We're going to continue our study tonight from John chapter 10, verses 1 through 21, and considerably beyond that. I want to include some thoughts that we were discussing last week. We'll begin kind of where we left off last time. In the 10th chapter, we noted in the first several verses of the chapter the illustration of the good shepherd and the sheepfold, and we noted the principle that the sheep, once they're in the sheepfold, they're separated by hearing the shepherd's voice and following the shepherd wherever the shepherd leads them. And Jesus then, in verse 7, identifies himself as the good shepherd. And he said he came that he might provide life and that we might have life more abundantly. He compared or contrasted himself to the thieves and the robbers who didn't own the sheep, didn't care for the sheep. And so when the wolves came, they fled, and the sheep then were consumed. In our study last time, we noted in the text beginning at verse 22 that we're talking about the Feast of Dedication. And Daphne, I think, gave us an exhaustive dissertation about the Feast of Dedication and the period of time in between the Old and the New Testament. When the Syrian king wanted to defile the temple in the city of Jerusalem and did so by offering a pig on the altar. And then the Maccabean period, the Maccabean revolt and the driving out the Syrians from the city of Jerusalem, the cleansing of the temple and the dedication then of the temple that resulted in what some today still celebrate as Hanukkah. And we've noted that that is in December, and the Feast of Booths that we were discussing in the 7th chapter, I believe, was in October. So that identifies the time of year for us. But the illustration that we're looking at here in this text of the shepherd and the sheepfold, this verse became so important, I think, to our study last time, and I want to reiterate it here. Because some believe that this text provides evidence for the doctrine of predestination, or once saved, then always saved, that if you're among those predestined unto salvation, then you can never sin in such a way so as to be lost. And we want to note the text again. Jesus said, "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish." We emphasized in our study last time these pronouns, that the key to this is hearing my voice. As long as one continues to hear his voice, then he'll not be snatched out of the hand of my Father. But the question then remains, is it possible for somebody to stop listening? Is it possible for somebody to stop hearing my voice? And that being the case, then yes, they shall be snatched out of my hand. They'll perish. So Jesus is not promising the Calvinistic doctrine of once saved, always saved in this passage. He's identifying the condition, which is always the case with the so-called proof text that the Calvinist uses. Here's the condition set forth. As long as you hear my voice, you'll not perish. But it is possible to stop listening, stop following. And we want to emphasize that. We've looked at a number of examples in our last study of how that one who is a believer can cease being a believer, and the necessity then of an active, obedient, working faith in order for us to be saved. And so I wanted to revisit that. I know that we closed that or ended with that on the close of our study last time rather hurriedly. I wanted to go back and revisit that and open the door then on that point for questions. Anybody have a question or a comment on that? I know some of you have had some questions about the doctrine of predestination and our study of the book of Revelation, and we've looked at it there a time or two, and of course we see other texts that are sometimes used as proof text. Any comments or questions? One of the key factors in studying the doctrine of predestination is to note that repeatedly throughout the scriptures, man is given a choice. John 7, verse 17, "If any man willeth to do his will, he shall know of the teaching, whether it is of God or whether I speak for myself." And then in our Revelation study, we've looked at this a number of times. the Spirit and the bride say, come, and he that heareth, let him say, come, and he that is athirst, let him come. He that will, let him take the water of life freely. And again, the invitation of the Lord, come unto me, all ye that labor. Now, we can reject an invitation. It's just that. It is an invitation. And this text sets that forth rather clearly. In Psalms 119, verse 30, I have chosen the way of faithfulness. Thine ordinances have I set before me. The element of choice is repeated, as we said, over and over and over and over. And Carolyn, I got this from the book that you gave me. I appreciate it so much. I use it frequently in studying on this subject. You'll see the source of it, the Presbyterian Book of Confessions. By the decree of God for the manifestation of his glory, some men and angels are predestined unto everlasting life, and others foreordained unto everlasting death. And then further in the same book, these angels and men thus predestined and foreordained are particularly and unchangeably designed. And their number is so certain and definite that it cannot be either increased or diminished. What do you think of that? Isn't that a profound statement? And of course, it's a perverted understanding of some of these passages that we've looked at. But we see that there is choice, and choice can change depending on your will. And that's the point that we want to remember from this. Now, if the doctrine of predestination be true from any of these passages, it would be impossible then for man to err. Notice again the statement. It's so unchangeable that it can't be increased or diminished. But you know it can. We can change our mind about where we are. Question, how could God give blessings if he had unchangeably decreed death? You remember Jonah was to go and preach against the Ninevites, and what were they to do? They had the opportunity to repent. So over and over, we see that in Old Testament history. How could God bless or curse a nation if it is unchangeably decreed? But yet in Deuteronomy 28 through 30, in what we sometimes refer to as the blessings and the curses, we see that they were given choice for either doing what God said or not doing. And also noting that if they chose not to do, they still had the choice to repent and choose to do. And we see that in Deuteronomy 30 verses 1 through 10. Joshua said, of course, for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah. Choose you this day whom you will serve. Then the text that we frequent occasionally is Joshua chapter 23, beginning in verse 16, that if you do what I say, I'll bless you. And if you don't, I'll destroy you from off this good land. Now, that's mixed paraphrase. How could God destroy the world if man's destiny was unchangeably decreed? Why did God grieve over their wickedness and as early as Genesis chapter 6, verse 6. Man has choice, doesn't he? And these passages, I think, make that overwhelmingly clear. Now, going back to our text of John chapter 10, we'll pass beyond the doctrine of predestination for just a moment. I want you to look, if you will, beginning at verse 30. In this text, as it continues, Jesus said, I and the Father are one. And the Jews took up stones again to stone him. And my question to you in this class is, did the Jews understand what he said? Did they understand his claim? Well, yes, they got it because they took up the stones yet again. And we saw that in the 8th chapter where they took up stones to kill him. And now they're trying or would do that again because he had claimed that he and the Father are one. Now, notice that he's not claiming that he and the Father are one person. When we talk with the oneness Pentecostal movement, folks, we have to establish that when Jesus was baptized, he was not a ventriloquist. He was not speaking from the cloud while at the same time in the form of the Son coming up out of the water and then in the form of the dove descending on himself. But yet we see three separate personalities. And when one is baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, these are three separate and distinct personalities. But what we do want to note is that Jesus, when he claimed to be one with the Father, is claiming to have the same nature. He is God robed in flesh, as we see very clearly stated here in Philippians chapter 2, beginning in verse 5 through verse 10, I believe it is, of that whole context. So how do the Jews respond? They've understood what he said. I and the Father are one. The text tells us they accuse him of blasphemy. Well, why was that accusation lodged? To claim to be God would indeed be blasphemy if you were not God. And what was the consequence of blasphemy? Well, the law made it very clear. The consequence was to be stoned. But you see, they didn't examine the evidence. And let me pause here and let somebody else talk. Why didn't they examine the evidence? Was there any inadequacy on behalf of the evidence? Well, what's Jesus just done in John chapter 9? What have they seen?
We saw him heal a blind man.
They did. A man had been blind since birth. And, of course, that was not the only miracle that Jesus had performed. John 20, verses 30 and 31 tells us many other signs, therefore, did Jesus in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. You see, Jesus had performed many miracles, and they had rejected the evidence. And again, I'll ask why. Why had they rejected the evidence?
Because they already knew what they believed.
They knew. They were prejudiced. They've made up their minds long before what they believed.
And the thing about blasphemy is, if anyone else had said, I and the Father are one, it would have been blasphemy.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's only one man that wasn't blasphemy, and that was the Son of God.
That's right. And it's because he offered up evidence that it was true. And we saw that in John chapter 5 repeatedly. You can look at verses 30 through the end of the chapter and not only see the evidence, but in John chapter 5, verses 30 and following, you get down to the end of that paragraph, you see the why. Jesus said in verse 43, I am come in my Father's name and ye receive me not. If another shall come in his own name, him will ye will receive. How can ye believe who receive glory one of another? And the glory that cometh from the only God, ye seek not. Think not that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one that accuseth you, even Moses, on whom you have set your hope. For if ye believe Moses, ye would believe me, for he wrote of me. But if ye believe not his writings, how shall ye believe my words? See, they'd not only rejected Moses, rejected Christ, they'd rejected Moses as well, and the evidence that Moses had presented. So they're not willing to accept anything that he has to say. Well, let's go back to John chapter 10 and read some more. Let's see. Who do we have? There, JD. You mind to do some reading for me?
No problem, Mickey.
Please, would you read for me verses 34 through 36, please, of John chapter 10, 34 through 36.
Jesus answered them, has it not been written in your law, I said you are gods? If he called them gods, to whom the word of God came, and the scripture cannot be broken, do you say of him, whom the Father sanctified and sent into the world, you are blaspheming, because I said I am the Son of God?
Interesting question, isn't it? Now, when he said that the scriptures cannot be broken, and it's written in the law that ye are gods. Context, context, context. When we examine the context of passages like this, for example, Psalms chapter 82, verse 6, and compare it to passages like what we have on the board, Exodus chapter 22 and verse 28, we see how that these who represented God and the appointed offices that they held were called gods. They were called sons of God in the scriptures, as we see. Then if they were not representative of God, they would be guilty of blasphemy themselves. But these folks didn't look upon them as being guilty of blasphemy. But how much more than Jesus, when he provides for them evidence? I want us to note this text of Exodus chapter 4. When we read of Moses being instructed to go and lead the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt, God said to Moses that you will be like God unto Aaron, your brother. And Aaron, your brother, in Exodus chapter 7, shall be a prophet unto you. We see how these terms are used in Exodus 22 and Psalms 82. These who served in these appointed capacities were called gods or sons of gods or sons of God. And Jesus is simply verifying the same, that he came from his Father and he is doing the will of his Father. So he's not doing anything but what they've already accepted it with others. But yet they're critical of him and accuse him of being guilty of blasphemy, such inconsistency. Jesus pointed out the scriptures cannot be broken. I heard a comment. Yes, sir. Okay. Exodus 22. Examine the context. Exodus 22, verse 28. Oh, okay. Yeah, the point being, as I understand it, is here's those who would revile God or curse a ruler of the people, they would be reviling God's appointed representatives. And in doing so, they would be accursed. So the point is, if Jesus is not reviling God or reviling God's representative, there's no point for them to accuse him of blasphemy and then be penalized with the penalty stated under the law. That wouldn't be appropriate. He is who he claimed to be. He's not denying or reviling anything or anybody. And he's provided for them adequate evidence to that end. So that's the point that I was trying to make on that. Well, the Father had confirmed who Jesus was by the works, the signs, which he did. We've noted already John 20, 30, and 31. Many other signs, therefore, did Jesus in the presence of the disciples. The purpose of the miracles is that you might believe three things, that he's the Christ, he's the Son of God, and that you can have life in his name. So the miracles serve a valid point. We're going to look at that more as we get over to the next portion of our study tonight from Luke chapter 10. But after saying these things to them in the 10th chapter, we learn that Jesus departed out of their hand. Verse 39, they sought again to take him, and he went forth out of their hand. The Bible does tell us how. No point in speculating on that. It's not the only time that such things occurred, but we can't answer the why. Why were they not able to take him?
Wasn't his time.
That's right. And a study of the Gospel of John, we see that repeated over and over again from John chapter 2 going forward all the way up to John chapter 12. My time is not yet come. And then in John chapter 12, my time is come. And we've noted that John chapter 12 becomes a benchmark because there is the beginning of the last week of Jesus' life. His time had come. Jesus went where John was baptizing. Many came to him. John had prepared the way. And strangely enough, John did not do any miracles. But Jesus has now performed many miracles, and they don't believe what Jesus has claimed. You find that ironic? What do you do in the face of a miracle like John chapter 9 that they've seen, or John chapter 5 where the multitudes, thousands have been fed with a little boy's lunch, and that following right on the heels of other miracles of healing? And then, of course, they, like John chapter 10, they want to know, why don't you show us or tell us plainly whether you are the Christ? Well, that's frustrating, isn't it? But that's where we're going to leave that and pick up then in the next sequence of events from Luke's account, from Luke chapter 10. But this is a good place for me to stop talking for just a moment and see if there's a question or a comment from the text of John. You guys are being mighty quiet tonight.
I have my hand up, Nick.
Oh, I'm sorry. I couldn't see you,
yeah.
Bruce.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But, you know, it would seem as if that since all this happened, that they would understand, you know, that that God, that he's the representative. And more than a representative, he is the Son of God. And it just appalls me because you have all these people, you know, who should have listened and have obeyed, but they keep on questioning them. And that's sad.
Well, yes. And as much evidence as he's offered and as many times as he's told them, I've become, just in the reading of the text, I've become frustrated with them, and their attitude myself, because the evidence is so overwhelming. And they keep saying, why don't you show us? Why don't you tell us? And he showed them over and over and over and told them the same thing over and over and over. And it makes you wonder just how many times and how many ways are there to say the same thing? And, of course, that's what we see in the preaching of the apostles, too, throughout the book of Acts, preaching the same thing over and over. Sometimes it was received. Sometimes it was not. And I think there's lessons to be gleaned from that, that if we think we've got to present something new, then think again. The message that you preach can be convincing when people hear it over and over and over. And then sometimes it's not convincing no matter how many times you tell it. And there's the frustration. Well, in Luke's account, I want to go back and pick up some things here from Luke chapter 10, beginning in verse 1. And it's some things that we've already addressed on the timeline from John's account. But we want to note that Jesus set his face toward Jerusalem. Let's go back and note from a previous study. I think Chris was conducting the study and established this point. But if you go back to chapter 9 of the book of Luke and begin at verse 51, John chapter 9, verse 51, in the sequence of events, it says, and it came to pass when the days were well nigh come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem and sent messengers before his face. And they went and entered into the village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. Now, that's what we're going to be seeing as our study continues this evening in Luke chapter 10, where he selects the 70 to go before him prepare the way for him to come. Now, you'd like to think that with the preaching of John and with the preaching of the apostles up in the region of Galilee and now the preaching of the 70 in the region of Judea and perhaps even southern Galilee and some on the Transjordan side of the region, that there would have been preparation adequately made to look forward to the coming of Jesus into the areas to preach. But when he got there, and perhaps word preceded him about the miracles that he had performed and the claims that he was making, what's the reaction of the people? It becomes somewhat consistent. Some received, some did not. Now, Luke is telling us about his journey through Samaria as he comes to Jerusalem. John, as we noted in John chapter 7, told us what occurred at the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths in Jerusalem. And then in John 10, we've talked about the Feast of Dedication, what is now called Hanukkah. And only Luke, with the possible reference, that should say. So, Richard, you'll make that correction before you put that online, please. Of Matthew 9 tells of the mission of these 70 to evangelize in Judea and southern Galilee and perhaps a bit on the Transjordan side as the apostles were instructed to do. And the parallel in the instructions given to the 70 to the instructions given to the 12, I think, is quite incredible. We'll notice that as we look at some of this going through. In the text of Luke 10, I'll pick it up there. And I think, again, while Chris was still in Lancaster, he addressed the text of Luke chapter 9, particularly in verse 62. No man having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom. Now, after these things, the Lord appointed 70 others and sent them two and two before his face into every city and place whither he himself was about to come. And he said unto them, the harvest indeed is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he send forth laborers into his harvest. Now, some believed in Jesus wherever he went. Some made excuses. Chris talked with us at some length about the excuses from verse 57 through 62. Now, in addition to the apostles, these 70 are sent two by two with very similar instructions that was given to the apostles regarding things that they were to do and things they were not to do. And I find the list of things they were not to do somewhat remarkable. But he prefaced that by saying, the harvest indeed is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Now, how many lessons have we heard on that? The harvest indeed is plenteous, but the laborers are few. I remember when I lived in this part of the country, Arkansas and Missouri, where some of you are very familiar, raise a lot of cotton. And when it's time to harvest the cotton, you look out across the field and it looks like it's covered with snow. The harvest indeed is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Jesus called upon these to look upon the harvest and see that the harvest is there, but we need more workers. And that becomes the issue, doesn't it? Sometimes when we categorize the work that we're to do, there are those who've never heard the gospel. They may be hearing it for the first time. Jesus instructed the apostles, go preach the gospel to every creature. The preaching of the gospel then becomes the fundamental primary work of the church, as it is the pillar and ground of the truth. Those early disciples that were scattered as a result of the persecution in the city of Jerusalem, wherever they went preaching the word. And by the way, on this point, those of you in Lancaster have heard me use this illustration. Others of you may not have, but I ask a Bible class of young people one time, if Lancaster was the only church on the top side of God's green earth and persecution became so intense because you're a Christian that it became necessary for you to flee the city of Lancaster, wherever you would go, would you take the gospel with you? Now you think on that, would you? Well, all of the young people in the class said, yes, that's what we would do. Now here's the catch. Are we doing it now? We don't have that kind of persecution, but are we availing ourselves of every opportunity to preach the gospel to those who've never heard it? Paul said to Timothy, preach the word in season and out of season. That's when it's popular or when it's not popular. You preach the word. Well, that's what they did in Acts 8 and verse 4. But we've got another category of folks. We've got folks who've heard the gospel, but they've not yet obeyed it. Lay that alongside Acts 2, if you will. With many other words, he exhorted them, saying, save yourselves from this crooked generation. You know, there's folks that have heard the gospel and they've never obeyed it. Maybe in our work as laborers, we need to exhort those who have heard it to do something about it. And then the next category, those who have heard it, those who have obeyed it, but they've not remained faithful. There's always work to do. In Galatians chapter 6, and I think sometimes, as folks in Lancaster well know, chapter divisions occur in some of the most unfortunate places, and we think that it's the beginning of a new thought when in fact it's a continuation of the thought of the preceding chapter. But in Galatians chapter 6, it follows on the heels of the lust of the flesh and the fruit of the spirit that's discussed in chapter 5. And then in chapter 6 beginning, he said, brethren, even if a man be overtaken in any trespass, ye who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, looking to thyself, lest thou also be tempted. Now, put the names on the players in chapter 6. Who are those who are overtaken in a trespass, and who are those who are spiritual in the context? I'd suggest to you that those who are overcome in a trespass are those who have been identified in chapter 5, who are no longer walking according to the spirit, but are walking after the flesh. And who are the spiritual in chapter 6, verse 1. I'd suggest to you that that's those who are walking after the spirit that is identified in verse 22 of chapter 5. Now, we're talking about brethren who have obeyed the gospel, and they have erred from the truth. Those who are spiritual, you be a laborer. You go teach them, help them to see their need to return. Now, there's another category that we want to talk about as we work and labor. It's not just teaching those who never heard the gospel. It's not just exhorting those who have heard it and not yet obeyed it. And it's not just trying to reach those who have obeyed it and they're not being faithful. But there's this category that's identified in chapter 6 of Galatians in verse 9 when he said, "And let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not." I think, frankly, we underestimate our efforts as laborers in simply encouraging the faithful not to become weary. And we understand what that word weary means. We get tired. You ever get tired? And you begin to think only of yourself. But we all do from time to time. And we've got to be thinking about those who might become weary. We can't become weary. The text tells us we'll reap if we faint not. Don't be weary. Paul, writing to those in Thessalonica in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and in verse 13, said, "But ye, brethren, be not weary in well-doing." Stay at it. Continue working. And wasn't that the point that we've established a number of times in the book of Revelation, and in particular Revelation chapter 2 and verse 3? There's not a place to quit. We can't give up. That's just not an option. And so we're important to each other. The work that we do with each other to try to encourage is labor, and we need laborers. But that's not all that Jesus said to these folks. He said, "The harvest indeed is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest to send forth laborers into his vineyard." Now, that presents a whole new line of thought. Pray that the Lord will send laborers. Are we just praying and not going? Or are we content to pray for somebody else to go? Are we willing to help somebody else to go? You know, there might be legitimate circumstances where you can't do the work, but you can pray that somebody else can be successful in doing it. We can do that. Yes, sir. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't see you, Bruce.
You know, Mickey, when you go back to Galatians verse 9, mine reads, "Let us not lose heart."
Yeah.
And to me, that's really strong, because no matter what, it is a heart condition. And if we lose heart in the gospel, we're losing our souls.
Well, that's right. And how do you lose heart? You ever do something you lose heart in? You get discouraged.
You get discouraged.
You give up. And that's what he's saying. You can't do that. And so do we not need each other to keep the fire lit? It's an important point, I believe, as far as becoming and being a laborer. I was talking with somebody this week, and he called me to see if I needed a car for the meeting in Jonesboro, Arkansas. And he lives about 35 miles north of Jonesboro. I'd be going through there on the way to Jonesboro. And he said, "If you need transportation, just let me know." I don't know how many meetings I've held in Missouri and Arkansas. This same fellow has provided for me transportation. And he can't go preach, but he can help me go. And I told him, I said, "You're a friend to preachers. You're such an encouragement to know that there may be things that I need and I can come to you for it." And he's just that way. And then he fussed at me. He said he knew a preacher that he'd become friends with, and he left Arkansas and went to California. So there we go. Any questions or comments just here? Well, I want to show you something. You know, sometimes I like to to get some facts and figures and to bounce off of you mathematicians to see what your thoughts are. Some time ago, I was doing a little research on polls and statistics and that sort of thing about people worshiping and working as laborers in the kingdom. And I found some research done by a familiar source, Pew Research Center. And the question was, quote, aside from weddings and funerals, how often do you attend religious services? More than once a week, once or twice a month, a few times a year, seldom or never. And here's the response. 54% of Americans say they attend religious services a few times a year or less. 45% say they attend at least monthly. Now, when I was doing this, the research material was from 2009 to 2018/19. And here's the graph. And you see where it is during this time frame. 52% said that they just attended sometimes. And here's how many were saying that they just don't. And it's going up. And it crossed right here in 2014. So now we've got more going downhill than there are going uphill. Does that speak volumes to you? So with the passing of time, more and more folks don't go at all. The next chart I want you to see is that in 2009, when I was doing some work on this, the time frame that was being examined, there were approximately 233 million adults in the United States, according to the Census Bureau. Pew Research Center, the survey conducted at the time, indicated that 77 of them represented themselves as Christians, which means that by this measure, there were approximately 178 million quote-unquote Christian adults in the U.S. in 2009. That was the period of time, the beginning period of time of the research. In 2019, 10 years later, there are roughly 23 million more adults in the U.S. than there were in 2009. About two-thirds of them, 65%, identify as Christians, according to this research. And this means that there were now roughly 167 million Christian adults in the U.S. Now, look at what we've got over here. Here we've got 233 million adults in the U.S., and 178 million of them claim to be something. And then here in 2019, 10 years later, we've got 23 million more adults, but less claiming to be something religious at all. Does that speak volumes to you? The population has increased dramatically, and those who profess to be anything religiously has decreased dramatically. One more time. The number of religiously unaffiliated adults, what was called religious nuns, they said, we're nothing religiously, in U.S. grew by almost 30 million people over this period of time. And you put yourself on that. What are we looking at? We've got a 23 million increase in population. But look at what's happened to those who profess to be Christians, profess to be anything religiously. Do you see a trend in that 10-year period? You think it's developed even further by today? Now, when Jesus said, the laborers are few, you see why? Now, that raises perhaps an interesting question. Where do you fit on this equation? Mm-hmm. There's work to do, brethren. And the number of people that are willing to do it is... And I understand the term Christian is used loosely on these graphs, but the folks that are willing to do it are becoming less and less and less and less, and the interest is becoming less and less and less. Now, what do you do according to 2 Timothy 4, verse 2? You preach the word in season and out of season, when it's popular, when it's not, when they like it, when they don't. When it's seasonable, when it's not, we need laborers. We need laborers because the laborers are entrusted to take God's message. And it's only the gospel that's going to convert anybody to become spiritual minded. Now, if their work was successful, there's going to be many other workers. Wasn't that the case in the book of Acts? as the word of God produced more disciples and the disciples multiplied, now wherever the disciples went, when they went home as a result of the persecution, the gospel was taken right along. And so you've got the spreading of the gospel. And that's essentially what Paul was instructing Timothy in 2 Timothy 2. I preach to you, taught you, and you teach others that they may be able to teach others also. And that's how the disciples multiplied. Yeah, the harvest indeed is plenteous. What do we need?
Laborers.
We need a lot of laborers.
Now, Mickey, I was looking at your chart, and I can see how, like, the census and all of that, you know, can give us numbers. But what if they did numbers with the Lord's church?
Well, frankly, I don't know of any numbers that exist that identify specifically the Lord's church. These are general numbers of folks who profess to be religious. They profess to be Christians. Now, you and I both know that they are not all Christians. They think they are, but they're not.
And I know the numbers are way, way less as far as those who are laborers.
Yes. Yes, and that mix of those who profess to be Christians, there's probably a lot of error being taught and believed. So you see the problems even with statistics, but it does show a trend. And I think that trend is legitimate. We need to see that the laborers are becoming less and less and less. But what about the fields? They're still white unto harvest, aren't they? Much work to do. All right, now how do we feel about that? Well, let's notice. All right, thank you, Richard. Keep in mind that our job is not to convert, but to teach. These 70, as you're looking back at our text of Luke chapter 10, it says the harvest indeed is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he send forth laborers into his vineyard. Now, we're going to talk about what they were to do, perhaps as our study progresses, maybe even next week. But what I want you to notice here is he's talking about the laborers and the magnitude of the job of harvesting. Our job is to teach. You ever get discouraged because you feel like maybe you're not converting very many folks? The Lord didn't command that you convert everybody. The Lord didn't convert everybody. In fact, in the setting that we're reading here in Luke and in John, we're finding that among the Jews, Jesus was being rejected. He didn't convert everybody, and he performed miracles. But that's not what he's requiring these folks to do. He's requiring them to work. Now, does that mean that we're always going to be successful? No, but it's our job to teach. No one's going to be converted if we're not teaching. There's no end to the work of teaching. And the groups that we identified a few moments ago, those who've never heard it, those who have heard it and they need to be exhorted, those who have obeyed it and have fallen away, and those who have become weary or tired. There's work to be done. Now, what did Jesus tell the apostles to do when he sent them out? Go preach. The command is to teach, make the message known. Well, what if people don't listen? You say, well, that's kind of discouraging. Yeah, it is. But that really hasn't changed, has it? That's always been discouraging when people don't listen. I was listening to a study. In fact, I was presenting some material from the book of Ezekiel quite some time ago, from Ezekiel chapter 2, where the Lord is giving instruction to this Old Testament prophet what his job was. And listen to what he said. In Ezekiel chapter 2, verse 8, he said, but thou, son of man, hear what I say unto thee. Be not thou rebellious like that rebellious house. Open thy mouth and eat that which I give thee. And when I looked, behold, a hand was put forth unto me, and lo, a roll of the book was written, and he spread it before me, and it was written within and without, and there were written therein lamentations and mournings and woe. And he said, son of man, eat that which thou findest, eat this roll, and go speak to the house of Israel. Now, what's he just told the prophet Ezekiel? Go speak. But how are they going to listen? How will they receive it? Will they listen? He said, no, they won't listen. But don't you be rebellious like they are. You go tell them. Now, in the third chapter of the book of Ezekiel, he tells him further, beginning in verse 16, it came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore hear the word at my mouth, and give them warning from me. When I say unto the wicked, Thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thy hand. Yet if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul. Again, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die because thou hast not given him warning. He shall die in his sin, and his righteous deeds which he hath done shall not be remembered, but his blood will I require at thy hand. Nevertheless, if thou warn the righteous man that the righteous sin not and he doth not sin, he shall surely live because he took warning, and thou hast delivered thy soul. Now, would Ezekiel be successful all of the time? Well, he's already told him you won't be. But did that excuse Ezekiel to not go teach? The laborers are few. The harvest, indeed, is plenteous. Sobering point, isn't it? And so we'll stop with that and close our study. But I want to know, are there any questions or comments? Any thoughts? Nobody got Mickey? A thought. Yes, Betty?
Mickey. Back in John, when on your chart, when it said scriptures cannot be broken, set aside, and made void at will, I want to, I'm wrong, right or wrong on this. Is that kind of sort of what denominations have been doing throughout the centuries? Because really, they're straying from the scriptures and teaching different things. And does that make any sense, or am I off base?
Well, I think you're right when you say that here's what denominations do and here's what they say. But Jesus is pointing out in this text that you're critical of me because I've made myself equal with God, but you've accepted the principle. You've accepted the principle that those who in times gone by spoke for God, that it was all right for them to be called God. But you're critical of me because I'm speaking from my Father. And I claim him as my Father. He's pointing out an inconsistency on their part. He's arguing is consistent with what the law said. And they'd accepted that, but they won't let him apply it.
Okay. All right. So I misunderstood that.
Well, perhaps just a little bit, but I think you're right in what you're having to say, that denominationalism wants to speak for God, and they don't, but Jesus did.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
You betcha. Any other comments or questions? Randy?
It reminds me of Matthew 15, beginning in verse 7, when Jesus said, you hypocrites.
Yeah.
Rightly did Isaiah prophesy of you. This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far away from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men.
Consistency, thou art a jewel. Yeah.
So that's one thing that Jesus taught consistently was against hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
And the hypocrisy of those who were condemning him is that they could clearly see that he was performing, that he was fulfilling all the scriptures, fulfilling all the prophecies. And yet they'd already decided that they didn't believe. So therefore, just ignore all the prophecies. Ignore all the miracles.
And why? How could they do that? He told them in John chapter 5. John chapter 12, we see it illustrated in verses 42 and 43. Who did they seek to please?
Men.
Each other, yeah. Themselves. Yeah. Good observation. Any other questions or comments? Well, we're going to pause in our study there and extend the Lord's invitation I always want to do this when we have opportunity to close out a study, that there may be somebody that's listening or participating that wants to obey the gospel or correct their lives, and beseech brethren to pray with them and for them, that their sin might be forgiven. Pray for strength as we face the days ahead. And we want to extend that opportunity to you to call upon any of us that can, and we'd be happy to help you in whatever way that we can to be right with the Lord.